You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Sidney Perkowitz. He's in Seattle, and we're going to learn more about him. He's a writer. Sidney, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, Brainerd, it's my pleasure to be with you.
Let's talk about what you're working on now. I mean, just to get an overview, what projects are you working on at the moment?
You know, I look for things to write about that have a science or tech component, but also would have a general interest. So a lot of my writing is about science and art. I just finished a brief article about a topic within that area. This is the idea that with technology now, you can make a black coating, which is the blackest black ever made. The point being that it reflects almost no light. Now, you might think that if you use black paint, that's very, very black, and indeed it is. But this black is beyond that. It's so black that when you look at it, it looks like you're looking through a hole into space. And it's phenomenally so different that artists have gotten quite involved in it. The point is, though, that it takes quite a high-tech process to make it. So in this black, this particular black was announced. It's called Vantablack. It's made by a company in the UK. Artists immediately wanted to jump on it. But it turned out that the company had sold all the rights to this Vantablack to one particular artist. He's very well known. He's won awards. His name is Anish Kapoor. He's a UK-based sculptor. But artists were really up in arms that the black was made available only to one person and not to them. So it's quite interesting. Technology can help art, and yet technology also involved with commerce and products that cost a lot of money to make. So what does that mean for artists? No one's yet begun to answer that question. It's really an interesting question. It'll pop up more and more and more, I think.
Well, let's talk about what you wrote about that. I mean, it's a fascinating issue, this Vantablack. So how exactly is that made? Or can we talk a little bit about what you wrote about that? Because how it was derived, right? Then there is the implications of what it means that only one artist can have it, which seems hard to even understand what that means, but how is it made? Where did this come from, and why is it so extraordinary?
Black, yeah. The science is very interesting, and I think it's not too hard to explain. Most people know that if you want to make something black, a good way to start it is with carbon because it's naturally black. So a lot of black paints and coatings have carbon in them, or graphite or soot, something carbon-based. But there's a technology now that will make little tiny nano cylinders of carbon. They're just a few billionths of a meter across. And the way to make this Vantablack is you make billions of these and arrange them upright like tiny trees in a tiny forest. And when the light hits these tiny trees, it bounces around among them, it gets absorbed, and the net effect is that after you've penetrated a small distance into this miniature forest, this nano forest, all the light has been absorbed. And total absorption means it's totally black. So that's the science behind it, and it's really quite a technological feat to make it. This all comes under the heading of nanotechnology. It's one of the products coming out now under nanotechnology. But as soon as artists heard that this is the blackest black ever made, they got really turned on, and then they found out that the company that made it, which wants to preserve it as under patent and under rights to sell it and so on, which is understandable, did not want to make it widely available. They just buttonholed it or earmarked it for one particular artist. Now, Anish Kapoor is a world-famous artist. The idea he has for using it is really quite nice. He wants to make a giant steel structure the size of a building, the inside of which is coated with this Vantablack. So if you, as a viewer, go in and stand inside this building, all you will see around you is that apparently you're surrounded by immense space. It looks like you're looking out into intergalactic space. And his aesthetic argument and also intellectual argument is when you're standing in the middle of it, you feel that you're in something whose inside is bigger than it could ever possibly appear. And he says that's how human consciousness is. Your imagination inside the tiny dome of your scalp, your head, is really much bigger than the head itself is. So it's a beautiful idea. You can't fault the idea. It's phenomenal if you could build it. But the fact that only one artist has access to it really had people up in arms.
And how is it, I mean, I want to talk more about that access too, but it's a fascinating medium. So this is, it's actually a paint that's produced? I mean, how is it applied to surfaces like canvas or the inside of a building?
Yeah, it's a little more complicated than just spreading it on with the brush. It's a long process that produces this little nano forest that I described. If the original process was quite complicated, and you really could not use it out in the real world. Now the company that is making it has come up with a spray that will let you put this on somewhat like flock to give you a black surface. So you spray it on, you end up with a good version of this little nanoforest, and then you have this deep black. So it will be available, but the company has rights to it. They invented it. It was quite expensive to produce, to invent and to produce. So they've just decided they're just going to release it to this one person.
Well, why? I mean, does the company have a rationale for that? Because it would seem to me that it wouldn't be financially viable even for the company to just, and I know Anish Kapoor is a huge artist, but still, just for one artist, why wouldn't they want it to be, you know, in the hands of many artists and used in a variety of ways, and so they would sell it more? I mean, they obviously want to sell this particular material, I would imagine.
Yeah, of course that makes sense, but the part that I didn't mention is that this black also has huge applications for optical work, astronomical work, and especially for military work. If you want to make something like a stealth aircraft or a stealth ship, one way to get to that is to try to make the object as black as possible so it absorbs light or radar or infrared or whatever. And that's where they'll make their real money. So I think putting it in the hands of a noted artist is a great way for them to get publicity and say, look, we're doing something that has aesthetic value too, but selling it to another 100 or 1,000 artists is not going to be their real moneymaker. The real moneymaker are the other applications.
Well, because so that's fascinating. So if an aircraft or a spaceship was covered with this, it would render it what we would think of as invisible. Is that correct?
That's right. The only way you could detect something that was 100% black would be if it passed in front of a light. If it passed between you and some light source, because it would still blank out the light. But otherwise, looking at it, you don't see anything. You just see basically black. So if you had a spacecraft out in space where it's black anyway, you wouldn't notice this at all. And again, you also have to think of wavelengths that are not just visible light, which we see with. You have to think of radar, which is what we use to detect aircraft. If it absorbs radar waves, it's the same effect. It's effectively invisible to radar. So it has tremendous military application. I think that's where the money and the big impact of this material will come.
But one artist, Kapoor, he has lifetime rights to that? I mean, how far does that extend?
I
would think at some point another artist would have access to it.
I've not seen the actual contract, so I'm not sure I can answer that. But it's been a couple of years since he got the rights, so it's been at least that long. I'm guessing at least I have a multi-year contract on it, perhaps 3 or 5 years, something like that. Also, let me mention again that whatever form you buy this in, the original form, which was quite hard to apply, or the spray form, this is not cheap. So the average artist, who goodness knows does not have hundreds of thousands of dollars to spread around, probably wouldn't be able to afford it anyway. Now, perhaps a company could say, you know what, as a gesture of support to the artistic community, we're going to make some of this available free. But I haven't heard that has happened yet, unfortunately.
Right, because the process is still very, very costly. It wouldn't be something that, as you're saying, would even be available to the average artist. It would have to be a fairly wealthy artist like Mr. Kapoor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Anish Kapoor has the rep and, I suppose, has the money, as artists go, to look like a really good candidate, to be the one person they single out.
Well, he also does a lot of public art, so I would imagine that's to their advantage, too, because people will be talking about this particular black. And is it named after the company, Vanta Black? Is it the company that made it?
No, the company is called Surrey Nanosystems in the UK. The Vanta Black is an acronym for what goes into it. For instance, the V stands for the fact that these little carbon cylinders are vertical. So that's just an acronym they've made up to describe the material.
That's fascinating, and it sounds like such an interesting thing to see. You know, of course, what we want to do is see these things now, but I guess we'll have to wait till some of Anish Kapoor's sculpture or the project that you mentioned is complete in order to see this.
For a while, you were able to see it online. There was a small exhibit illustrating how this black works in a science museum in London, and even in a photo. When you look at an area painted or coated with this stuff, it's phenomenal. The reason is anything that you and I would call black, like ordinary black paint, still reflects some light. So when it does that, if there's any surface irregularity, the little bit of reflection shows that it has some hills and valleys or some texture. But this stuff absorbs just about everything. It absorbs 99.99% of incoming light. And that means that what bounces off it is virtually nothing, and it just looks like it's totally flat, no texture whatsoever. It really looks like a hole in space. It's quite a striking effect. You wouldn't think it would be that powerful, but it is.
So, Sydney, if the light is completely absorbed, and this may be my own naivete, but how is it that light can completely disappear? Because I would think light itself is also energy, and how can it be absorbed and literally go nowhere? That sounds like it's being destroyed almost.
Yeah, it does sound that way, but there actually is a pretty simple answer to that. And the answer is something you feel whenever you sit in the sun. When you sit in the sun, sunlight hits your skin, and you don't think that it goes anywhere, but it does. What happens is your skin heats up. So the energy of the light is changed into heat, and that's what happens with this Vanta Black. The light gets in, bounces around among all these little carbon pillars, and then it heats them up just a little bit. So it's not been lost, it's just been transferred into heat energy.
It's fascinating, really fascinating idea. And so I wanted to also talk about the other thing that you're working on, which you were beginning to discuss at the start of this interview.
Yes, this is a book that will be out in a couple of years, but it's always good to mention it early. 2018 is a very important anniversary. That's the 200th year since Mary Shelley wrote her original story of Frankenstein. And you don't have to be any kind of an expert on Frankenstein to know that Frankenstein is a name and a situation, a story that's known worldwide. So the 200th anniversary of the publication of the book is going to be a big deal for science and for media. The science part is, in a way, we're getting closer to Frankenstein, although I hate to put it that way, but because of the way genetic engineering is going, we're getting closer to modifying people and perhaps someday actually making artificial people. And the media part is Frankenstein.
But we're already doing that with animals, aren't we? I was just reading an article today about how a South Korean firm can clone your dog, your dead dog, and they've been doing that with animals for a while in South Korea for purposes of testing or replicating animals with unusual sensitivities.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Cloning has been around for a while. Listeners will remember Dolly the sheep, who was the first animal to be cloned now quite a few years ago, 8 or 10 years ago. So cloning has been around for a while, and that's the first step toward making new kinds of organisms. But we're now talking about the next step, where you can actually get into an organism's DNA and change what the DNA has encoded in it so that the result that comes out is no longer exactly, let's say, a cat, but a cat that's been modified. Maybe it has bigger ears or different color eyes or a different kind of temperament. And then when you extend that idea to humans, well then it gets really scary and really very concerning.
Well, concerning as well as I would think hopeful, I've begun to read a book by George Church, Regenesis, and in that book he talks about just this idea of what it means to be manipulating DNA, and he's saying it could also turn into things like resistance to all viruses or the idea of creating a seed that could essentially be planted and an entire house would grow from it, including the electricity. I mean, these things seem kind of extraordinary, but in his book, he talks about it as we're getting very close to them actually happening.
You picked a great name. George Church is one of the people who's a leader a spearheader, you might even say, in what genetic engineering can do for us. And yes, most of the things he talks about are wonderful things. There are all kinds of ideas in how command of DNA could make us more disease resistant, get rid of genetically based diseases, things that have a genetic component like breast cancer, and even go beyond that, maybe even engineer humans who are still human, but are better, stronger humans, not just disease-free, but maybe physically stronger, maybe mentally smarter or whatever. So the upside is very, very powerful, but the downside is also powerful, and it's probably because of the Frankenstein legend. People kind of jump back to that and have a kind of horrid reaction. One great example of that is genetically modified food. There's been a huge outcry against that. All the science says it's not an issue. You can eat that food, it's just perfectly okay, but people seem to have a revulsion toward it. So the mix of good and bad is kind of complicated. It's not really straightforward.
Well, let's get into that a little bit, because there's some interesting overlaps here, because I know when, you know, Monsanto was initially, you know, talked about and there was this revulsion to it, part of that revulsion was the term Frankenfood, right? That was becoming popularized and was part of what, you know, is now making people label food everywhere as GMOs. But you're a scientist. You know much more about this than I do and most people. So why should we not be afraid of food with genetically modified ingredients in it?
You know, I think it really comes down to a very visceral reaction. I mean, anything you put in your body, you're very suspicious of. If you even eat food off a dirty plate in a restaurant, you get a little bit upset. And now a bunch of I'm trying to play the devil's advocate here. A bunch of scientists comes along and says, well, we know that this is all okay. The DNA is okay. It's okay to go ahead and eat. You're really asking people to overcome a lot of emotional reluctance. I think a lot of it comes down to faith. You know, I'm a scientist. I know scientists. And I believe that the average scientist is not interested in doing evil, is not even interested in making a lot of money, although some scientists would like to make a lot of money, but generally that's not the motivation. They just want to do good science, and they do not want their science to hurt people. So I have some trust that when the scientists say it's okay, it really is okay. But whether the average person has any reason to believe that, that's a little harder.
But from your point of view, genetically modified foods, I mean, you're taking what you're trusting the scientists, but also from a scientific point of view, is there anything about a genetically modified food that would be dangerous to us, or that we should be cautious about? Because I agree with you, there's the emotional thing, there's the belief, and a number of other issues that aren't really that tangible. But is there really is no danger, or there is one?
I'd say what gets people most upset, and this is meaningful, the scientists worry about it too, is DNA is a very, very complicated thing. The human DNA has what are called 3 billion base pairs. Those are the basic components of the DNA molecule that define everything about your physical and mental characteristics. It has 3 billion of them. A corn or something else that you might eat is less complicated, but still has hundreds of thousands or millions of base pairs. So the fear is if you modify just a couple of them, let's say to make the corn more drought resistant, are you really sure that you've isolated exactly the genes that do only that and do not change anything else unknowingly? And that's a fair question. So it comes down to have the scientists study the DNA of the corn or whatever it is they're working on, enough to know that the genetic change they're making is really the change they want to make and is not doing anything additional. Some of the older GMO foods have now been that kind of GMO control for decades, and it's been tested every possible way so you can trust it. If it's brand new, then I think it's quite fair to ask, are you sure that the genetics is solid? So that's the one point you have to be careful of.
And before, when we were talking about the book that you were writing, there's two reactions to this this anniversary coming around of the original story, and you were saying there's the reaction of people, but you were also about to say there was a media reaction too that we can expect.
Yeah, that one of the most interesting things about Frankenstein, just from the media viewpoint, is what a powerful story it is. There's some evidence that this is the most widely republished novel ever, and it has not been out of print in 200 years. There are that many different editions of it. I've written 7 books, and if one of my books stays in print for 3 or 5 years, I'm doing great. And this story is so powerful that it's gripped us for 200 years as a literary story, and then it's had literally hundreds of film and TV versions put out too. So there's something about the story that's very, very powerful that expresses how widespread it is in the media, how widespread in different mediums, and how long it's been around. It really hits at something deep in us.
And so, should we explore or talk a little bit about what that is? And is that part of what your book is addressing? Kind of why this story resonates so much in us?
Yes, I have some ideas about it, and I'll express them in the book. Let me point out, by the way, that I'm not writing the whole book. I and a co-editor are editing it. We're going to have chapters from about 15 or 18 different people, all the way from scientists to media people, talking about what Frankenstein means in their different areas. By the way, one of our media people is Mel Brooks. We interviewed him to ask him what he thought about his film Young Frankenstein, which turns out to be extremely popular. All these years later, still very popular. But my chapter is going to be exactly what you're talking about. Should we really worry that science can start to do this kind of manipulation of DNA? Why is it so deep? Why do we keep tying it to Frankenstein? And are the fears really real fears or imaginary fears? I think we tie it to Frankenstein because I think the whole topic of making synthetic life for us is just a way for us to think about death without it being too scary. It kind of has the hidden message that maybe we don't have to die, maybe we can replicate ourselves or make better versions of ourselves. If not live forever, at least live better and live longer. So I think there's a lot of deep, visceral reaction about the reality of death that comes into the power of any story about making a synthetic being. The Frankenstein story is the oldest one, but we have modern ones that are just as strong. The Commander Data on Star Trek is a very popular character, as you know. So I think he represents almost a modern version of the same set of worries and the same set of beliefs.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I look forward to this book coming out. Before we go, I've been asking everybody what books you're reading now. Can you share with us what you're reading at the moment?
Yes, but it's a completely different area than we've been talking about. I'm in Seattle right now, but mostly I live in Atlanta. And, you know, if you live in the South, the Civil War is still very real. So there's a big Civil War exhibit going on at the Atlanta Historical Society. And my wife volunteers there. She runs tours of what the Civil War is all about. We've both gotten deeply, deeply into Civil War history and are reading book after book about this. It's the most fascinating thing, and a lot of what is going on right this minute, right today, Tuesday, 2016 in the U.S., really has its roots going back to the Civil War. So anyone who wants to understand the U.S., I think, has to go back to this really crucial moment and try to understand how it led to where we are today.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So you mean things like the election season we're in now, and people like Trump and the kind of, I mean, if this isn't too much of a stretch, also has its roots in the Civil War or that you know, ethic of where so many Americans are coming from, or does it not filter into the culture, do you think, quite that way in terms of political figures and influence?
Yeah, I'm not sure I draw a direct line to any particular figure, although maybe you could make that connection too. But how racism has changed and still appears in our society has its roots back into what happened at the end of the Civil War when the slaves were supposedly given their freedom and Southern blacks were free people, and yet it didn't work out that way. What showed up instead was Jim Crow. So I think we're still seeing the consequences of that in many different ways. You can point it certainly at political parties and maybe some individuals, but overall it's part of how American society is structured now.
Sydney, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure talking about your books and work.
My pleasure, Brainard.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.